21st of January 2017 in Melbourne, Australia. And we're going to be looking at four very powerful keys to raising your children in Krishna consciousness. People ask all the time, you know, should I homeschool? Should I send my child to an ordinary school? Should I send them to Gurukula in some other country? Should I move to another country? Should I have sadhana with my children every morning and every evening? Should I be super strict and never let them watch a Disney movie? Should I let them watch anything that they please? You know, what are the most important things? And I will tell you that when I first started raising children in Krishna consciousness, if I was asked what is the most important thing, I would have given you a very different answer than I would give you today. So when I first started raising children, I felt that the most important thing were example and habit. And I find if you ask people, what do you think is the most important thing, they'll often also say example. Now, of course, very little children learn mostly by imitation, isn't it? Right? Very little babies, they just imitate whatever you do. It used to be the way human society was organized that people had very consistent examples. What your parents did, what your uncles and aunties did, what your grandparents did, what your friends did, was all basically the same. And you didn't get much exposure to other ways of life and other cultures. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, just like in the 1950s, 1960s, when if you wanted to watch the news, you would go to a movie theater and you would see a tape of the news that was 1 or 2 weeks old. If you wanted to talk to somebody across the ocean, you couldn't do it. There were no phone lines going under the ocean. You had to send a letter and you had to wait a month for it to get there. And when I was a child, I went across the Atlantic by plane, and it was a propeller plane. So people used to only be exposed to what they were growing up with, unless you were in some huge city like London or New York. You know, basically you were exposed to what was in your immediate environment. And therefore, example was often all that was needed to train children. They just saw a consistent example, they didn't see any other example, and that's what they ended up doing. And whatever habits they got, whatever examples they got, was enough. In our modern world, this is no longer the case. How many different examples are our children exposed to? Dozens, isn't it? Even if you think, I'm going to keep them home and be sheltered, my dear friends, that will not 100% work. No, it just will not. Even other devotees will have other standards and so forth. Our children will become aware that there's many, many different choices and many, many different examples. So that's not going to make it. It's certainly important. Having a good example and forming good habits in the children is certainly important. But it is no longer the defining factor. So we're going to look at four things, each one of which is so powerful that it will transmit culture and values to our children. What to speak if two or three or all four of them are there? And what's really elegant about these four things is these are things you can do even if your circumstances are less than ideal. Does anyone here have the perfect ideal circumstances for raising their children in Krishna consciousness? Not one person said that they did. Often people ask me, you know, should I move here? Should I do this to make my circumstances ideal? But Krishna says, Abrahma Bhuvanaloka Punaravarti Narjuna Mamapecha Chupanteya Punajanma Nabhijite. There's difficulty everywhere. You'll have one difficulty in India and one kind of difficulty in Australia, right? Different kind of difficulty, but you're going to have difficulty. So even if you look at your life and say, all right, my situation isn't perfect, still these will have a great effect even in very difficult situations. So the first one we're going to look at has to do with relationships. There's one very famous psychologist who's an animal trainer also. Her name is Karen Pryor. And she says that young animals do not respond to reward and punishment. She said, if you're going to try to train a young animal, reward and punishment is completely ineffective. Until the animal gets to a certain age, they don't respond to such things. And she says the same is true for very young children. Her conclusion was that living beings are not programmed to be obedient. She does note, though, that even very small animals will try to please another creature. And her conclusion is what we are wired to do is to please someone. To please someone and to love someone. We can be trained to be obedient, but it's not really who we are. Many times people say, you know, how can I ask my child to always obey me? And I look at them and I say, do you always obey yourself? Does anyone here do, even in one day, everything that you told yourself to do in that one day? So if I don't even listen to my own self, do you all have this problem? Am I the only one? You know, if we don't even listen to our own self, how do I expect somebody else is going to listen to me? And you know, the spiritual world is not really about obedience. It's just not. It's not that Krishna's there, okay, obey. Reward, punishment. You know, there is reward and punishment in this world in the form of karma. But in our ultimate reality, that's not what's going on. And, you know, Krishna doesn't always listen to Mother Yasoda. Correct? She says, please don't go to the forest today. I'm worried about you. And he goes anyway. Even Radharani doesn't always listen to Krishna. Sometimes she says, I'm not going to see you today. So this is the actual reality is that we are living beings. But what we will do is we will modify our behavior if we are convinced that somebody loves us. I'd like you all to think for a moment. Is there someone in your life for whom you have willingly changed your values and your behavior and your character? I'm going to think if there's anyone in your life for whom you have joyfully, willingly said, I want to be a different kind of person to please this person. How many of you have had somebody like that in your life? I think most of us have had more than one person like that in our life. Now, why was that? Usually those are people with whom there's a reciprocal relationship of love and trust, where I'm convinced that that person cares about me and I care about them. Sometimes it's a one way. Sometimes we change our behavior for someone we admire that we haven't met. Like people will change their behavior and their values for some famous person or some inspiring person that they read about in a book or they saw in a movie, right? And they may get so inspired and they feel so much affection for that person even though that person doesn't know them. But there's some kind of love and trust, and it tends to be deeper if it's reciprocal. So I tell this story very often about my own father. My father used to wake up at 5 every morning. My mother didn't wake up till about 10 in the morning. And my father would be with me every morning for about 2 hours until he went to work or until I had to go to school. And he did that from the time I was 2 years old until I went to university. Now, my father was the CEO of a multinational company. He was a temple president, not a Hare Krishna temple, but he was a temple president. He was certainly a very busy person, but he gave me that time every morning. And what did he do? He played games with me. We had dolls that we played with. He would tell me stories. He would teach me about morals and ethics. He made my breakfast. My father never cooked a day in his life, but he would toast bread for me, and he would put butter and honey on it. And he would always make fresh orange juice. He had one of these. You see them still in India, the carts on the side of the road, the hand ones, you know, we push down on it. So he would always, I still to this day love fresh orange juice. And because he would spend those 2 hours with me every day, just simply being with me, I became very, very attached to him. Such that practically anything he asked me to do or not do, I would do. And in contrast, my mother, who didn't do that with me, I did not have that kind of relationship with her. I mean, I loved my mother, but I wasn't really willing to change myself to please her. Does this make sense to everybody? You know, my main relationship with my mother is she would show me off to her friends, and she would take me to educational places that she thought were good for me. But my father just spent time with me as a superior friend. So, for example, starting when I was 3 years old, my father used to say to me, "Don't ever smoke." Now, this was before people understood that cigarettes caused cancer. This is when there were still cigarette advertisements on the television and so forth. And basically because he said that, I never smoked. So when I got to secondary school, to high school, most of my friends smoked. But I didn't. Not because I was afraid of cancer, but because I didn't want to hurt my father. I didn't want to do anything that would cause my father any pain. When I got Gayatri Mantra from Srila Prabhupada, my father at that same time gave Srila Prabhupada a check for life membership. And Srila Prabhupada said, "Good father, good daughter." And we see that this kind of relationship is not a matter of a title. It's not that because I am the mother, because I am the father, because I am the guru, because I am the temple president, therefore people should listen to me. It is a question of a relationship of love and trust, where we actually want to please that person. We want to do what will make them happy, and we don't want to do what will make them unhappy. If we have that kind of relationship with a Krishna conscious person, we're naturally going to want to be Krishna conscious. If we have those relationships with persons who are not so Krishna conscious, then we're going to want to please them by being not so Krishna conscious. So if the relationships we have with devotees are mostly official or authoritarian, and the relationships of love and trust we have are with the non-devotees, then we are going to mold ourselves after the non-devotees. Does this make sense to everybody? Yeah? So the first thing is relationships of love and trust. Can we all say that together?
Relationships of love and trust.
Now just having that can be enough. In the seventh canto, it says that the brahmachari lives at the home of the guru with a great bond of love. And Prabhupada, speaking about this in 1976 in Mumbai, he said, if there's no love between disciple and guru, then why should you put yourself under the control of another person? Does it take more time and more effort to develop these relationships than just do what I say because? Certainly. One of the benefits of having children and raising children is that it pushes us to have authentic relationships of love and trust. And I should say, in general, sometimes people think that I can best be Krishna conscious if I'm a renunciate, right? And I could have more time for focused sadhana, and I could read the books more and go to the holy places. On one level, that may be true. On another level, being a parent is one of the best situations for becoming Krishna conscious. The impetus for becoming Krishna conscious, the facility for becoming Krishna conscious when you have children, is actually much, 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 much greater and much, much, much easier than for those in the renounced orders. If you take the benefits that being a parent give you. In order to raise the children nicely, you want to have relationships of love and trust. Then the second thing we're going to look at is one of the main ways in which culture and values has been passed down from generation to generation in every culture of the world. And the main way in which culture is being spread and values are being taught in our modern age. What is the main way right now that culture and values are being taught to people? The media. The media has radically changed the culture of the entire world. and in a very short time. The media is made up almost entirely of stories. Even most music is a very short story. Most advertisements are very short stories. One can change the entire view of a culture 180 degrees just through stories. It was stories about the environment that changed society from worshiping science and technology to being ecologically minded. On the negative side, it was stories which made people decide that abortion was okay. Oh, there's some poor 13-year-old girl that was, you know, molested, and what are we going to do? You understand? If you just talk about the facts, people say, no, 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 we don't want to do that. You tell stories, and people change their values. In traditional societies, every evening, the community would gather together and hear and tell stories. Now, why are stories so powerful? First of all, because they bypass the false ego. Right? So let's say, like here, I assume all of you are honest, right? Everyone here is honest. I don't need to worry about my equipment. Anybody here prepared to say they're 100% honest? Anybody 100% honest? Okay, so let's say I try to use direct instruction. And I say, you're not 100% honest. What's going on here? This is terrible. How do you expect to become a devotee of Krishna if you're not 100%? Does that work for you? Anybody like that? Is that going to change your values or your behavior? You'll feel bad for a couple seconds. That'll be about it, right? And then you'll just go on in life. But suppose I tell you a story. I tell you a story about a little boy who was watching sheep. You all know this story? He was watching the sheep, and it's really boring watching sheep. That's what people do when they want to go to sleep. So he's watching the sheep, and he's like, oh, this is so boring. And he thought, I know how I can get some excitement. And he runs into the village, and he said, there's a wolf, gonna eat the sheep, there's a wolf, help, help, help. And the villagers come with their weapons, and they're looking around. I don't see any wolf. I don't see any wolf prints. I don't see any wolf poop. I don't think there was a wolf. Oh, there was, I saw one over there. He was even howling. Okay. And they all went back to the village, and the boy said, that was fun. A few weeks go by, he's still watching the sheep. Oh, gosh, the sheep is so boring. I remember that day I had so much fun when I pretended there was a wolf here. So he runs back to the village again. There's a wolf! There's a wolf! Not quite as many people come, and they didn't come quite so fast, but they did come with their weapons, and they did look around, and no wolf prints, no missing sheep, no signs of a wolf. You sure you saw a wolf around here? Oh, yeah, I did. He was right over there. All right. A few weeks go by, and again, he's like, oh, boy, this has got to be the most boring job on the whole planet. Why didn't I study my mathematics lessons? I could have gotten a job in IT, you know, instead of being out here with the sheep. Oh, I know. And he goes back in the village. There's a wolf! There's a wolf! There's a wolf! And now not very many people came. Only a few people came, but they brought their weapons and they looked around for a long, long time. And they didn't see any sign of a wolf at all. And the next week, there was a real wolf. And then when he ran to the village and said, wolf, wolf, nobody came. So what was more interesting, my yelling at you and giving you direct instruction or telling you a story? So why this story? And I'm sure most of you already knew that story. It wasn't even a new one. First of all, it bypasses our resistance. We just think, this isn't about me. It's about some little boy with sheep. You understand? And then do with me. And so we drop our false ego. Also, we like stories. We like stories because we're part of Krishna, and Krishna likes stories. Do you know every night Krishna listens to stories? Did you know that? Every evening, there's some kind of entertainment. Usually the stories are about Krishna. So Krishna and the cowherd boys and the cowherd men, they watch entertainment about Krishna's incarnations. You know, before Krishna goes to the forest every morning, Madhyasoda ties a special amulet around his wrist that has some Nisinga Kavacha in it. And she says, if any demons come, you just pray to Nisinga Dev. And so Rupa Goswami says, Krishna's repressing a smile. And Rupa Goswami says, may that repressed smile bless you all. So Krishna loves to hear stories, and Krishna loves to be in stories. That's all he does. For all eternity, he's in stories. So we, as part and parcel of Krishna, we also really enjoy stories. Now, it bypasses the conscious resistance. We enjoy it. And the other interesting thing is when we hear or read a story, watch a story, we end up almost living what we're hearing, watching, or reading, don't we? Right? If you're watching a film or you're reading a book that's a story, you start to feel what the characters are feeling, isn't it? Right? Then you are just sitting in a chair and there's an explosion and you jump. There's something scary in the story and your heart starts beating. Isn't that a fact? Right? What's happening in the brain when we're watching a story or reading a story or hearing a story is as if we're doing what the characters are doing. So if we watch, listen to, read stories about people doing virtuous things, it's as if we're practicing doing virtuous things. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Right? Just like, you know, athletes, they often mentally practice before they go and play. Or we also mentally practice things. If we're going in for a big interview or we're doing something difficult, we mentally rehearse, isn't it? When we watch, read, listen to stories, we are mentally rehearsing what we would ourselves do in our own lives. It's a way of practicing without having to actually go physically and practice. So what the values, the behaviors that we see, hear, and read in stories become our own habits. You can understand how detrimental it would be if our stories are all about evil and violent people, right? And this is, of course, actually what's happening in our modern society. My own personal opinion is that children under the age of 5 do not need any books or any stories that are not directly about Krishna. That it's just not necessary under the age of 5 for any reason whatsoever. First of all, little children are very happy to read the same book 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 or 10,000 or 20,000 times, as those of you who have little children know very well. So very young children do not need a wide variety of books. And we have our number of Krishna conscious books for little children is growing all the time. So when they're very young, just stories about Krishna, Krishna's devotees, and stories that support our values. Once they go to school, they certainly need to be exposed to more things. But these can also be stories that support our devotional values. So the second thing is stories. First was of
love and
trust. Not just relationships. Relationships of love and trust. And second is stories. I know of families where the only Krishna conscious thing they did was tell their children stories every evening, and all 4 of their children became initiated devotees. And that was the only thing they did. They didn't do anything else. Just from that. They didn't have any other sadhana, any other practice. They lived far from a temple. Just from that. Now, you may know that in addition to books, we also have many, many recordings of stories in the form of songs. And we are all very blessed here that we all understand English. You know, we may not appreciate that, but in places of the world where people don't understand English and want to be devotees, that facility is not so much available to them. So we have many, 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 many songs about Krishna stories, and the children can learn these stories often through songs. One day in the forest of Talavan, Lord Krishna and Balaram killed the Danukasura by wheeling him around and around. Okay, the third one. All of us want to feel that what we're doing is valuable. We all want to feel that our life has meaning. We all want to feel motivated and excited about our life. And any place, any organization, any circumstance that gives us a feeling of meaning and personal satisfaction is one that we will want to be a part of. One of the most discouraging things is feeling that we don't really have anything to contribute that has any value. If you look at empirical studies of what motivates people, which is my particular area of study, you'll find that the main things that motivate people are doing something that is according to their nature, for a greater purpose, for something greater than themselves, to a level of expertise or mastery. These principles, of course, are the essential principles of Varnashrama. You work according to your nature, for the pleasure of God, not just for your own pleasure, and you do it to a high level of expertise. Am I correct? That is the basic principle of Varnashrama. That is also the basic principle of the spiritual world. In our ultimate reality, we become self-realized. We find who I am. Oh, I am a cowherd boy, or, you know. I'm a gopi, or I'm a flower. And we realize our identity. We use that identity for the pleasure of Krishna at a very high level of expertise. This is what we are looking for. Materially, doing things that are meaningful and valuable is ultimately frustrating. First of all, our material identity is not our real identity. Second of all, the greater purposes for which we work in this world are usually not worthy purposes. And the last thing is that people don't even usually appreciate or notice our level of expertise, isn't that? Right? You can spend decades becoming expert at something and still people don't even pay any attention to you. Yes, we all have this experience? So in Krishna consciousness, we can offer this kind of satisfaction to a level that's not experienced materialistically. To find what someone is expert in on a material level, according to our temporary false identity, and ultimately according to our real identity. We can offer that in the service of the greatest whole, Krishna. And our level of expertise is not just how good we are at the technical or external aspects, but also our intention. Krishna's idea of expertise is that we have the right intention. Try doing that just materially. It doesn't work very well, does it? If you just say, well, I had good intentions. But Krishna is mostly interested in the intention, not in the external. Of course, if you have good intention, you try to make the external good also. Now, in traditional societies, children were trained in doing meaningful service from a very young age. Krishna himself was taking care of the calves before he was 6 years old. And he was taking care of the cows from the age of six. Such an idea is inconceivable in our modern society, and in most Western countries you'd be arrested for child abuse or neglect. Right? But this concept that children should do meaningful work from a very young age was part of all traditional cultures. And in fact, children like to do this. Have you noticed that little children want to do something that's helpful? In fact, they often want to do that more when they're 2 and 3 than when they're 12 and 13. It's a natural urge to want to be helpful. Even when I asked these 3-year-olds to pass out the papers, they were very happy to do something that was meaningful and valued. Isn't that correct? Yes? The sad and ironic thing is that often when we engage children in Krishna consciousness, we engage them in doing things that are not particularly meaningful, that are not particularly valued, and are not even particularly according to their nature. We'll get together at Sunday school, and all the kids do is color pictures or something. You know, and then every once in a while we have them do a whole display of what they did, and nobody's interested except for the parents. This is Lord Ram. Ye crossed the ocean on a bridge. But it doesn't have any meaning. It doesn't have any value for the community. I mean, okay, that's nice that they're learning something. But suppose the children can be engaged in doing something valuable for the community. Now, I don't know if he's still here. I remember one time when I came here to Melbourne, there was an 8 or 9 year old boy that was helping with the finances and the accounting and going on book distribution. Do any of you remember that boy? It was a few years ago. He was like 8 or 9 years old. He used to distribute a lot of books. Arvin, is he still here? Or have they moved away? They're in India now? Uh-huh. So you might think, well, that's extraordinary, but you know what? It's not extraordinary. You can start training your children from a young age to do things that are not just coloring and not just, but really valuable for the community. Certainly by the time they're 11, and at the latest 14, to have the kids do meaningful service. Meaningful service means something that they really like to do, not just it's needed, but something especially that's an expression of their personality and their nature, where they can become expert at it and where the community values it. Where they can see it's actually used by the community. If you train your children in meaningful service, not only will they want to be Krishna conscious, but they'll also want to be part of the community of ISKCON, where they're able to find that meaningful service. So the third is meaningful service. So the first is? Second? Third, meaningful service. Now, the fourth one is something that we know about. It affects all of our lives. But most of us probably don't think about it very often. And we probably don't use it consciously and intentionally. So I'd like to ask all of you, how many of you have a certain kind of food that as soon as you eat it, it brings on an emotional state? How many of you have some kind of food that brings on an emotional state? What about a particular piece of music? How many of you have a particular piece of music that brings on an emotional state? A certain smell. Any of you have a certain smell? It does that. Certain place. Any of you have a certain place? So this relationship between some sensory input and an emotional state is called either a trigger or an anchor. That there's a relationship formed in us between a place, a time of day, a person, a taste, a smell, a piece of music, a certain activity, and a particular emotional state. This relationship happens in one of two ways. It happens either through repeated weak experiences or one very strong experience. By the way, do you notice that these children were completely quiet when I was telling a story? Did any of you notice that? As soon as I started telling a story, they all became very attentive, and when I stopped telling stories, I lost their attention. Just something to notice about stories, like kind of hypnotize people. Actually, really, your brain waves goes to another place. Anyway, to get back to triggers, just noticing that. And I'm not telling stories, they're in another universe. Huh? So remember I was telling you about my father, right? So I always love the early morning. I mean, I really love it here in Melbourne that in the early morning I can walk out to the ocean and watch the sunrise. And I just assumed that everybody liked the early morning. I just thought, the early morning's great. And I remember, as a Gurukul teacher, one time one of my students said, you know, I really don't like the early morning. And I thought, really? There's someone who doesn't like early mornings? I couldn't even fathom it. I was just, it was such a strange concept to me. And then all of a sudden I thought, why do I like the early? If it's not something that everybody likes, which was just such a radical idea to me. And I thought, why is it that I like it? And after some introspection, I realized it's because I associate emotionally the early morning with that very sweet time with my father. I have an emotional association. The early mornings to me bring out a feeling of love and security and friendship and protection. Right? I know with some people, you know, staying up late meant that they were grown up, right? And so people associate, you know, late nights with the idea of being an adult and freedom and things like that. So that's a weak, a repeated weak association. Or we used to live in a place where to get to the mail, we had to go down a steep hill. And it was always, who's going to go down and get the mail today? And at a certain point, I started getting the mail every day. And my kids started asking me, hey, you have this nice paper, can I see it? Will it fly? You think? Can I try it? How far do you think I can make it fly? Terrible. See if you can make a better one, okay? But can you make it really quietly? See if you can make a better one that I can make fly one. So I went down to the mailbox after a while. I was going there every day. My kid said to me, Mata, why are you getting the mail every day? Listen. Hey, listen. You know, he's only 3, so he's going to make noise, but I don't think you're 3. How old are you? So I said, why are you going every day? And I couldn't figure out why. And then I remembered that when we were building our Gurukula, at one point I got a check in the mail for $35,000. And I was standing right at the mailbox when I opened the letter. And so I got this emotional connection between standing at the mailbox, right, and getting this $35,000 donation. So after that, I always went to get the mail. Now, on the negative side, we used to live in Detroit, and Canada was a 20-minute drive across the border, and in those days, there was a much larger Indian population in Canada, in Toronto, and in Windsor, than there was in Detroit. So the big Indian stores were all in Windsor. So once a month, I would drive over the border. In those days, you need a passport. I would drive over the border and get our basmati rice and our asfatida and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes the kids would come with me. And one time my daughter, who was about 6 or 7 at the time, said, you know, Mata, I'd like to come with you. So I took her. And when we got to the big store, she said, I don't want to go in. Can I wait in the car? I sure. So I come back after 10 minutes and she's hiding under the dashboard. I said, what happened? She said, Mata, there was some man in the parking lot and I think he was one of those bad men that kidnapped girls and I was so scared I was hiding in the car. And she told me for years after that, if she would hear the word Canada, she would feel afraid. So these are the ways that these triggers get established, either through repeated weak experiences or through one strong experience. I also know one devotee, she's in her 40s. She was raised in the Krishna consciousness movement. She took initiation, but she didn't take initiation from a Gaudiya Sampradaya. She took initiation in a different sampradaya, although she's very much a devotee and very much connected with ISKCON. And I asked her why, and she said, I can't chant japa. I said, why is that? She said, well, when I was a child, I was yelled at and punished if I didn't chant correctly. And she said, so I can't even touch japa beads. She said, as soon as I touch japa beads, immediately I feel fearful and angry. So that was a repeated weak experience. So, you know, we have rules in the Shastra that you're not supposed to chastise anyone in front of the deities, for example. And I'm sure part of the reason is Krishna doesn't like hearing people yelling. But another reason is that you then set up this negative emotional experience with the deities or with the temple. Right? And these things can be fixed, by the way. You can rewire these kind of experiences, although that's not always so easy. And we see this in education. We see a kid who was yelled at or shamed during mathematics and then they hate mathematics. Right? I had one student who was from a Chinese family, very, very smart girl, but she was failing her mathematics tests. And it turned out that her parents were really heavy with her about mathematics. You know, you really have to do well, you really have to do well. And when I went to see what was wrong, she said, you know, every time I get out a mathematics test, I feel like all my ancestors are in the room watching me. You know? So immediately she just froze with fear, and although she knew the material, She wasn't able to do the test. Now, in her case, we were able to kind of rewire that that trigger for her and fix the problem. But we definitely don't want our children to have negative emotional experiences connected with the temple room, the altar in our home, the time when we do sadhana, the activities of sadhana. In fact, we want them to have positive emotional experiences. Now, in fact, every culture tries to do this. That's one of the main purposes of holidays and festivals in every culture. You know, in every country of the world, there's some big holiday that has to do with patriotism, isn't it? The country's Independence Day or something, and there's fireworks, and there's special food, and there's parties. And so you get this emotionally positive experience connected with your country. And we try, every religion does the same kind of thing. They're trying to create these either repeated weak experiences or a very strong, one very strong experience, or both. So you'll connect, like if you had a very loving family and you ate together, then you connect your family with that good food. Okay? Okay? So this is, you know, if your child's misbehaving during your sadhana time, try to correct them later. Or at least correct them in another place. Take them out of the temple room, correct them out of the temple. I see this problem come up a lot during a class. You know, we'll bring the kids during the class, and the whole time that they're in the class, they're just being corrected. You follow? Yeah. Well, we're very lucky in this temple. This is a very child-welcoming temple, but not all temples are like that. And some of our temples, people will be like, can you get that kid out of here? Can you get that kid out of here? Can you get that kid out of here? And, you know, eventually the kid becomes 18 and they say, okay, I'm going. So the fourth one is positive emotional experiences. So again, first one is?
Relationships with love and trust.
Second is?
Story.
Third is? Meaningful service. And the fourth is? Positive emotional experiences. Okay. So I want to look at some of these questions that you've written. I won't be able to do all of them tonight. I will look at these also tonight, and we'll discuss some of these tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be doing about motivating our children to engage in a variety of service, which we touched on a little bit today with the idea of meaningful service. But we'll get into that further. So any of them that I don't get to today, I will try to get to tomorrow. And if you think of something at home and you want to write it down, bring it tomorrow. We'll do our best to get to that as well. So I'm going to pick these by the ones that are easiest to answer in the next 20 minutes, basically. And somewhat randomly. Okay, I think we'll do that first. How to make our parents listen to us sometimes? Okay, well, the best way to get someone to listen to you, kids, when they're your superior, this is going to sound really funny. The best way to get your parents to listen to you is that when they do tell you no, smile and say okay. Now, it doesn't seem like you're like, what? How would that work? Well, it's really interesting. If when you ask your parents for something and they say no, and you smile and say, okay, next time you're going to want to say yes. It's a very interesting thing. The other thing is try to ask your parents for things when they're not busy or tired or sick. Okay? Because Krishna talks a lot about this in the Bhagavad Gita. He talks about that in the mode of ignorance, we do things at the wrong time in the wrong place. So adults are really, really funny, and when they're tired or busy or sick, they'll usually say no, even if they would normally say yes. Okay, that's the kind of funny thing about the adult species. So try to get them when they're in a good mood. And the other thing you can do to try to get your parents to listen to you is try to first think about why they might say no. Think about why might they say no, and sort of be ready for those arguments. And plan it out a little bit in advance. Okay, this is a very good one. How to control my anger with my son when he does not listen. We get angry in this world mostly because we feel some kind of threat to ourselves. Anger mostly comes as a way of defending ourselves, defending our body, defending our family, defending our clan, defending our resources, and also defending our status. One of the main reasons that adults become angry with children when the children don't listen is it's a threat to their status. Why does that matter? Because without having a certain amount of status, it's hard to get resources. So understand that anger is primarily a biological, chemical drive, which is necessary for material survival. If we are being threatened, anger releases all kinds of chemicals in our body that greatly increase our strength, our endurance, and our focus. Anger narrows your vision. That's very, very useful if somebody's trying to kill you. It's extremely useful. Or if someone's trying to kill your family member. If there's some danger, it's a very useful mechanism. Your child being disobedient is not really in that category. But it may feel like that. It might feel like my status is being threatened. My territory is being threatened. And the Bhagavatam says anger just comes out of the sky. Now, the main way to control anger, which is one of the three gates to hell. Okay. Again, anger is very useful if we're actually in danger. It's a very useful thing. It just like releases all these chemicals and focuses us, and we can take somebody who's trying to kill us and flip them over even if we've never learned judo. You've read about such things, right? You know, the mother picks up the car off of her kid. Or you jump in front of a train to save somebody. You know, it gives you like superhuman ability. So it has that function. But anger generally simply harms us spiritually. The main, generally in our lives, being angry is one of the most spiritually harmful emotions that we can experience. Repressing anger isn't effective. It's effective very temporarily as an emergency so you don't kill somebody. But that's not the way to deal with anger. Controlling anger doesn't mean hating it. It doesn't mean sitting on it. It doesn't mean ignoring it. It doesn't mean repressing it. Rather, it means becoming the observer. Being able to say, oh, there's anger in my body. This is a natural biochemical reaction to a threat. It was put in my body by the Lord to save me from tigers and thieves and, you know, that kind of situation. That's what it was meant for. My child is not a threat to me. My child's disobedience is not a threat to me. I am not going to lose status or position or resources just because my child is being disobedient. I am not under threat. Therefore, I do not need this biochemical reaction. It is not necessary. It is not useful. It is not me. It is something programmed into my body for defense. Be able to take that observer position. And then to say to the anger, you can stay, you can go, I am not going to make you welcome, I am not going to throw you out, you do whatever you want, but you have nothing to do with me. It's very nice, Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, He talks about how by contemplating the sense objects, we become attached. From attachment comes lust. From lust comes anger. And then right after that, he says one should be free from both attachment and aversion, each situation. He never says, hate your anger and repress it. He said, don't either grab it or hate it. Just observe. Oh, that's a natural reaction in the body. But I don't need to act on it. I can just observe it. Is it applicable to this situation? No. My 8-year-old kid is talking back to me. It's not applicable. He's not a threat. Now, there can also be loving anger. Anger is a rasa in the spiritual world. But that's a very different thing. Loving anger, that spiritual anger, fills us with joy and doesn't pollute us. Most of us do not experience that in teenagers. But there is a kind of anger one can have, not because you feel threatened, but because you actually love your child. But that kind of anger, again, we don't experience that very often. Sometimes we do. And that is not polluting. You can tell that it's not a polluting thing if it's actually coming from affection. When Krishna gets angry at the jivas, he's only loving. Krishna's anger is loving and it's actually playful. The anger of the liberated souls is also like that. It's something playful and it's something based upon only love. It's not based upon defense. We may experience that sometimes in our life. Very excellent. Okay, I have difficulty getting my child to listen to me now, although he was obedient previously. I would look at the love and trust relationship thing. Also, there's a lot of just mundane books out there that are very, very good about different methods of child training. And even though they're not spiritual per se, you'll find that they're often very useful. And I'd say that if you're really having trouble getting your child to cooperate, you might try to explore some of these and see which ones work for you, because this is a very individual thing. Ways of dealing between parent and child that work for one family may not be suitable to another. It's usually best to have some kind of system where your child takes the bulk of the responsibility for their own behavior, rather than it all being that you're telling the child what to do. So I know we set up a system at my son's house where we had a board on the wall with pockets, one for each child, and then we had different colored strips of foam that each represented the different things that we really wanted the child to do. So one of them was doing at least 15 minutes of something spiritual every morning. One of them was having all your clothes off the floor by 11 o'clock. One of them was getting your schoolwork done because you're homeschooling, so you got, you know, different things for each class. So we had different, you know, doing your chores without being reminded, because all the kids have chores, but had to be doing your chores with either 0 or 1 reminder. And the kids themselves, when they would do these things, they would take the colored foam and put it in the pockets. They had to be at least 4 years old. Kids under 40 would do that. And then at the end of the day, they would count up their tokens and they would get like a little sweet at dinner time. But we'd give them even like a dried apricot or something. But it wasn't so much that we were giving them the fruit. It was that they were announcing what they got in front of the family. And they have a big family, so you know, I got 32 points, and it was more the reciprocation from the family. One of the things we did also is everybody every day was supposed to give out some love points. So if somebody was nice to you, you didn't necessarily tell them, you just put a love point in their pocket. So at the end of the day, you saw how many love points you got, and you didn't even necessarily know what you got them for. So you were like, what did I do today that was really nice? So people were doing random nice things to each other. And then you could give a black point if somebody insulted you. But you couldn't argue with the person. Like if you gave someone a black, they couldn't argue with you about it. They could argue with the parent, but they couldn't argue with the other kid. And within a week or so, everybody was nice to each other. It was quite interesting. And it was not so much because we were giving out, you know, a piece of date or dried apricot or something like that at dinner time to the kids who got the points. It wasn't so much that. But that we were setting a mood in the family of this is what we value, and the kids were taking their own responsibility. So it really didn't eliminate, but it way cut down the adults telling the kids what to do throughout the day and expecting the kids to obey. That whole system where I'm telling someone what to do and they do what I say. Does anybody here like being told what to do? Right. Okay. This is a non-parenting question. How can I inspire kids to become Krishna conscious? That was the whole topic of this class. While we know that most of the individuals have normal IQ, our heart as parents wants our kid to perform better than others. When our kids don't turn out to be super performers, then at least a disappointment. How should we be happy with our normal kids? What a great question. Okay, what's at the root of this? What are the problems at the root of this? Envy. What else? Huh? Comparison, which is envy. What else? Status. What else? Huh? Attachment. What else? Pride. Right? Also, fear. A lot of the status and fear is, yes?
Expectations.
So a lot of this is, you know, if my kids aren't super, they're going to miss out in life. They won't get as high of a status. They won't get as much enjoyment. And people won't think I'm a super parent. And they'll think there's something wrong with me. And they'll criticize me. And I won't think I'm a super parent either. So we talked about this with Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, this concept that I am a very good parent. And if I am a very good parent, I will have super kids. That is my measure of being a very good parent. You know what? We're not really parents, my dear friends. We are souls. This relationship we have, that I am this person's parent, is not real. It is a job, it is a service we are doing for the Lord. It is not our identity. My worth as a living being is not judged by how good I am at playing a role in this world. I already have worth to Krishna as I am. I am trying to do my role in this world only to please the Lord. Only to please the Lord. And what the Lord wants us to do for our children is do the best we can to help them become self-realized beings who can also function in the world. That's all and that's enough. And our intention to do that and our efforts to do that to the best of our ability at any given moment. And the best of our ability at any given moment is not necessarily the best of our ability at a different given moment. Right? The best of our ability on Tuesday at 8 a.m. may be a little different than the best of our ability Wednesday at 10 p.m. Correct? But at any given moment, to the best we can at that moment, to have the intention, let Krishna be pleased with how I'm dealing with his soul, who's been temporarily entrusted to me in the form of my child.
No.
And that is enough. That is always enough. Trying to compete in this world to be the best at something that we aren't anyway, and thinking we're going to change our children's destiny or something like this, is all simply going to bring us misery. It's not so easy to do. Okay, our something-year-old child will soon go to a materialistic school. We are concerned about the bad association he'll be subjected to. In this regard, What are the options? We have homeschooling, etc. Homeschooling is a very good option, and although I spent 19 years of my life running schools and 27 years of my life teaching in schools, I'm a very school person. I've seen that, mostly Christian conscious schools, except for 1 year, I've seen that the kids who are homeschooled tend to have better character. I mean, I just have to say frankly. Overall, not every individual, but overall, the kids who are homeschooled come out better character. They come out more responsible, they come out more mature. If they're homeschooled as Krishna conscious, they tend to come out more Krishna conscious. That is just a fact. I really haven't seen practically any school that can compete with a good homeschooler. And I've dedicated my whole life to schools. So homeschooling is a really, really nice option if you can do it. And I'm not that familiar with the specifics of the Australian homeschooling situation, so you really need to ask. I can tell you a lot about America, but I couldn't tell you that much about Australia. So if you're considering homeschooling, then I suggest you speak to people who are more knowledgeable in this country. You know, with all these kids here, somebody ought to think about opening a school. You have a lot of children. And the children are very much part of the community. And in fact, I've rarely visited a community where the children are this much welcomed and this much part of the community. So you might want to put that on your agenda at some point. Is it okay to be strict with prasad and food and avoid outside food, chips, biscuits, ice creams? Or am I fanatic? People say I might be fanatic to be too strict on him. Please suggest. You know, you're never going to please everybody. You know the story of the man with the donkey? The man and his boy with the donkey. I don't think you're too fanatic. I mean, we raised our kids that we only ate food cooked by devotees except for some rare emergency, unusual situations. And it's certainly healthier for them physically to eat home-cooked meals. There's no doubt about that at all. It's much healthier for them on a physical level. There's all kinds of garden stuff in the modern food, all kinds of dyes and chemicals. The food you buy on the shelf is between 6 and 12 months old. My youngest son ran a prasada company for a couple years. My father was in the food business. The food you buy on the shelf is 6 to 12 months old. Just think of what they have to put in it to make it look and seem fresh. It's really not very nice food. And the consciousness of the people making the food is in the food. You know, if you've ever seen like Kirlian photography, if you take bread that was like home-baked, it has a very strong aura, and as soon as an angry person touches it, the aura decreases. If you've ever been to a food factory, and my father ran a food business, I spent a lot of time at his factory, the people that work in those factories, let's put this politely, are not generally the most high-class people. So you could say it's made by machines, but it's not really. People are managing the machines, they're touching the machines. And the factory cooked food and the food you find in the supermarkets, it's not only really bad for you spiritually, it's not only really bad for your consciousness, it's also really bad for your physical and psychological health. So I think to want to give your children home cooked meals and want to give your children prasad that's cooked by devotees is one of the most wonderful things you can do for your children. So if you can't do that 100%, you know, we all have our lives and our difficulties, but if you can do that, then why not do it? You know, I don't see any reason whatsoever to give your children a taste for garden food. What would be the benefit? I just don't see what the benefit is. And if you're not that expert of a cook, then maybe you can share with other people and switch meals sometimes. And you can learn how to make all kinds of treats at home. Ice cream, and you can ice cream maker. And make your own ice cream at home. Okay, I have the other questions here. I will look through these, as I said, for tomorrow. If you have any more questions, you can also bring them for tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll be going over how to motivate our children to do service for Krishna, and also I'll be dealing with these questions. And again, if you didn't write something today, you can do it tomorrow. I hope you found this helpful. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada.